Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today on this Tax Tuesday Practitioners Forum. Again, it's part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. And because of the holidays and the new year, we're going to go dark in January. It's January 2nd, the first Tuesday in January. So our next Practitioners Forum is not going to be until February 6th. So please mark your calendars. February 6th is going to be our next Practitioners Forum. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly, because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today. We asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging on to the call, and that also that you have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order of when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak to us freely. One of the things that we like to do also is give you the opportunity to type in your question, because we know a lot of you are a little shy and don't want to come onto the microphone or the speaker, but you're more than welcome to type in your question, and I will address it here for everyone to hear. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxing agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, and be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. Today is the first Tuesday of the month, and each first Tuesday of the month is Practitioner Call. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday Lightning Deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. On the third Tuesdays of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. Remember, we are here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And we do want to make an announcement to everyone just to make sure that you guys are kept up to date. Norman, go ahead.
So for those of you in California, on January 2nd, 2018, the California Franchise Tax Board will start using a new power of attorney and tax information authorization forms. These forms will be released on December 13th, 2017. So all power of attorney forms received prior to January 2nd, 2018 will be processed. And all power of attorney declarations filed after January 1st, 2018 will expire 6 years from the signature date. So be sure to file the new power of attorney if you're going to be filing any power of attorneys after the first of the year.
Thank you, Norman. Yes, we want to make sure you guys are up to date on what's going on. As soon as we hear or know of any changes on any of the agencies, we want to bring that information to you. All right, so now let's go ahead and move forward to the question and answer section of today's practitioners forum. As we always mention, the members of our website get priority in these calls. So the first series of questions here were submitted by members. Again, if you're interested in becoming a member, becoming a VIP member, I will be pushing link to you with a special promo, including information on what it entails or what you get. Aside from taking priority in these calls, you get consultation time, you get access to our e-learning courses, you get access to our webinars. There's a lot that comes along with a membership for the Tax Resolution Institute, and I'll be pushing some information to you guys here soon. So, all right, moving on to the questions. The first one here was submitted by Christopher. He's a member and is an enrolled agent. His question is, will tax liens filed for prior tax liabilities be released if the taxes are discharged through bankruptcy?
So the answer is eventually yes, but because the taxes are discharged against the individual, it means that the court doesn't have what's called in personam jurisdiction, which means that they don't have the ability to collect the discharge taxes from the individual, but they still retain what's called in rem jurisdiction, which means that they still have jurisdiction over property. So there is a scenario where the taxes are discharged and the IRS can't garnish the taxpayer's paycheck or levy their bank account, but that the lien is still on their house, so that if the taxpayer sold the house and there was equity, that the IRS could still get paid even though the taxes were discharged. But there are several ways of getting that lien released. One is if the taxpayer doesn't own real property and doesn't have really any assets of value, the IRS may release the lien on its own. And the way to determine that is by ordering account transcripts after the bankruptcy discharge. And you'll see on the IRS account transcript, it will say a bankruptcy case filed, and then it will say a bankruptcy case discharged and taxes abated, and there'll be a write-off for the tax. And if the lien is released, it will say lien released. If the IRS doesn't automatically release the lien, you can contact them and request that they release the lien. It used to be done with what's called the lien desk, and it's now called the advisory group. And you would contact the advisory group, and you would submit certain documentation, for instance, schedules A and B of the bankruptcy petition, which is the listing of real and personal property. And depending on the value of the debtor's real and personal property and their equity in it, you can negotiate a release of the lien by paying the IRS the value of their lien, which would be the value of the collateral that the lien attaches to. And the third way of releasing the lien is when the CSET expires. So again, even if the lien hasn't been released from bankruptcy, and even though the tax is not collectible against the individual, when the CSET expires, the lien expires. So you'd look at the CSET and remember that that's the collection statute expiration date. And remember, the collection statute would be told from the time that the taxpayer was in bankruptcy until 6 months after the discharge. So you would add that time to the CSAT, and when the CSAT expired, the liens would have to be released. So those are the three ways of getting the lien released after bankruptcy.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Christopher, hopefully that helps you out there. Josh, moving on, is asking a question. He's also a member who's a CPA. He's asking, a client of mine has racked up several years of tax liability, $220,000 approximately. We just realized he is also going to owe for 2017 another $50,000. An NIL has just been issued on November 20th. What can I do to delay collection activity long enough to file his return next year? We don't want to have to default on an installment agreement if I set it up now.
Right. I mean, you'd really want to include 2017 in any installment agreement. So a couple things come to mind. One is the NIL was issued 11/20, and you usually give it 30 days, so that would become collectible, let's say 12/20. But the thing is, the IRS has a moratorium on collection every year around Christmas. It begins a week or so before Christmas and usually goes through the new year, and that's just because they don't want to levy your Christmas account and get a lot of people upset. So they don't advertise it. And I asked somebody at ACS the other day when the collection on moratorium for Christmas comes up this year. And they told me, one, they don't know, and two, if they did know, they wouldn't tell me. So it's not something they advertise, but something to keep in mind that the IRS doesn't like to levy during Christmas. What I'm thinking, though, is with an additional $50,000 added to the $220,000, it would be over the $250,000 threshold for the case to be assigned to a revenue officer. So what I would do is wait till after the new year and call ACS and say that you would like the case to be referred out to a local revenue officer. It's the term they use is in queue. You tell them that you want the case to be in queue for referral to a local revenue officer. And when that is done, the case is taken out of ACS, so ACS won't collect, and it takes, 60, 90 days for the revenue officer to get assigned, and then the revenue officer has 30 days from the date that they get the case to when they need to start working it. So with a little bit of luck, you can get the 2017 return filed before it gets assigned to a revenue officer. And the return doesn't need to be processed. It just needs to be received by the IRS. And that's called a pre-assessment installment agreement, so that the pre-assessed liability will get included in the installment agreement, theoretically. And I say that because almost every time we work out a pre-assessment installment agreement this time of year or between January and April, somehow it falls through the cracks. But if it's done right, and especially if you do it through a revenue officer, the letter approving the installment agreement will include that the IRS should put in the mod that of 2017 is not been assessed yet, but when it does, it will be included in the installment agreement and won't default it. So I think that's the best way to do it, but I would prepare that 2017 return as soon as you can.
It's good advice there, Josh. And again, to these members, if you guys need further clarification or want us to dive in a little bit deeper to the responses, use up that consultation time that comes up with your membership and set up a call with Norman, one of our CPAs, or any of our other professionals to go into more detail. Moving on, next one is also a member. This is Charles, who's an attorney. Charles is asking, when should FOIA requests be made and what should be included? Charles, I want to ask you for follow-up information here because the FOIA requests are, you can do a FOIA request for any number of things, and I need to know exactly specifically what you're looking for. Is this for taxpayer-related information? I don't have information, so if you're on the call and it looks like you are, go ahead and type in the questions box, or maybe I'll open it up into the afternoon and ask you to clarify what type of FOIA request you need. All right, so we'll give you some time to get that in. Next one is also a member. This is Damien. He is asking, I submitted and got approved an OIC for an IRS liability of $150,000. We settled for $20,000, but the IRS wants a collateral agreement for the next 5 years. Number one, is this common? Number two, can you explain how this really works?
Right. So I would say it's not unusual. I don't know if it's common or not, but it's not unusual. They don't do it every time. They do it when the taxpayer may have the possibility of making more money in the future. So that, you know, maybe for some reason they're in a low-paying job now, but the IRS feels that in the future they're going to be making more money. And so the collateral agreement says that the offer is $20,000 plus a certain percentage of any amount that the taxpayer makes in the next 5 years over a certain amount, something like that, so that if the taxpayer makes significantly more money in the next 5 years, that that $20,000 installment agreement is going to, $20,000 offer is going to be actually more than $20,000 because they're going to take a percentage of the taxpayer's income for years that the taxpayer makes over a certain amount of money, whatever the collateral agreement says. So that's not unusual. I mean, even in any offer, if the taxpayer has to file all returns timely for the next 5 years and not owe any additional taxes for the next 5 years, or the offer is rescinded, and if the taxpayer won the lottery or something, the IRS would want to get paid. So there are always strings attached to an offer. The IRS is willing to take a lump sum payment less than what's owed, but only with certain conditions. And sometimes the collateral agreement is one of the conditions that they insist on.
All right, Damien, hopefully that helps you. Moving on to Marcia, also a member. She's asking, I just requested to have several years abated on an IRS tax liability for a client totaling $12,000. The IRS rep said that the computer told them the client only qualifies for $650. How do they determine what penalties qualify for the first-time penalty abatement program?
Yeah, so the first-time penalty abatement is only good for one penalty, 1 year. So what happened in this case probably is that the 650 was the penalty of the earliest year, and they applied the abatement to the penalty of the earliest year because that's what qualified for first-time penalty abatement, because that was the first penalty that they accrued. But that subsequent penalties, which were higher, were not abated. There may be grounds to abate those other penalties. So even though the first-time penalty abatement only applied to that earliest penalty, the other penalties may qualify under what's called reasonable cause. So one strategy on how to work this kind of thing is to look at the transcripts before you call to abate the penalty and see which penalty is the earliest, and maybe if it's a small one, pay it and not request that that penalty be abated, but request that another penalty be abated. but that's how it works. And yeah, unfortunately, sometimes the earliest penalty isn't the largest, and so you're just abating a small amount of it. So you should look at other reasons to abate penalties, such as reasonable cause, and maybe get rid of some extra ones too.
And if also, Norman, I believe the first-time penalty abatement is only every 3 years. Can you exercise your right to do a first-time penalty abatement?
Yeah, you can control. I mean, if you do a little pre-planning, you control which penalty will be abated. But you have to kind of
put a strategy together.
You have to have a plan.
All right, moving on. Next question here is from Carl. Carl's an EA, and he's asking, I have something I'm not sure how I should handle. Doing a 433A, and the taxpayer is living with his fiance and her child. The child has autism and receives $735 a month in Social Security and SSI. She does not work. Taxpayer has not taken either his fiance or her child on his tax return. He has two children that he does take, and I'm assuming as dependents, but he is supporting all five people in the household. My question is, can I show the fiancé and her child as dependents on the 433, and would I need to show the $735 per month? I hope this is enough info, but if you need anything further, just let me know.
Yeah, so the IRS treats this a little bit different than, for instance, the state of California to determine who or what makes up the household. For IRS purposes, they look at the tax return. So if the taxpayer didn't claim and probably couldn't claim the fiance and her child as a dependent on their last filed return, then the IRS is not going to include them as members of the household for terms of two things, income and expenses. So let's keep the fiancé and her child off of the 433A. So the 433A is going to be the taxpayer and the taxpayer's two children. So he doesn't need then to include the 735 SSI because that's the fiancé and the fiancé's child's income. But then again, he's not going to be allowed to claim expenses of the fiancé and the fiancé's child. So the 433A should be him as the sole income producer, and then expenses for a household of three, which would be him and his two children. And do the calculations based on the household of three. And I don't know, but does he file head of household return? So, but that's the way I would do it, and not include the fiance or her child. Now, California would be a little different. California, you may, but IRS, I wouldn't, and I don't think you could.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. Hopefully that answers your question there, Carl. If not, take advantage of the membership and give us a call. Moving on to Markway. Markway is asking a question. A business client owes the trust fund recovery penalty and made an installment agreement with the IRS. The IRS made a 4180 interview and determined that the individuals are responsible as well. How can they avoid trust fund from being assessed to them individually? And what is the process to follow to make a revenue officer understand? What code section needs to be invoked?
Okay, so I'm not sure what we want the revenue officer to understand. If the 4180 interview took place and the revenue officer determined that the taxpayer was a responsible person and that therefore assessed the trust fund recovery penalty against them, first of all, usually when they do the 4180, they also want the taxpayer to complete a 433A. So one ground to request that the revenue officer not assess the trust fund recovery penalty against the individual is if the 433A shows that the individual has no ability to to pay the trust fund. So sometimes you get out of it with the 433A. But if they didn't do that, or if they didn't qualify under the 433A, well, then the assessment can't be stopped. I mean, unless you're disputing that they're a responsible person, and then you have 60 days from the date of the notice of proposed assessment of the trust fund recovery penalty to dispute it. If not, then you you waive that, and the trust fund recovery penalty assessment becomes final 60 days after the proposal. So if they've been assessed the trust fund penalty, then the next question is, can they collect the trust fund penalty? And there is a section in the Internal Revenue Manual called Status 63, which says that if there's an installment agreement with the company and the company's paying the delinquent payroll tax liability, which includes the trust fund, that you can get put a hold on collection to the individuals that have been assessed a trust fund penalty as long as the company stays in compliance and continues making its installment payments. So I would ask the revenue officer to look at IRM and to look at Status 63 and see if the taxpayer doesn't qualify, even though they've been assessed, collection is put on hold to allow the corporation to pay the tax, and the individual is free.
Right. So in that situation, the 4180 assessment doesn't have it's inconsequential to the client itself as long as the company abides by the agreement.
Right, because it's like a mirrored transcript. If you looked at the transcript of the corporation, let's say, and the payroll tax liability, and then you looked at the individual who's been assessed a trust fund penalty, where, well, the payments that the corporation's making to lower the payroll tax liability, about half of that is the trust fund recovery penalty. So the taxpayer will be getting credits for payments that the corporation's making, not dollar to dollar, about 50 cents on the dollar. And the individual's transcript will show those payments reducing their personal liability. And at some point, their personal liability will be paid off.
Okay, thank you, Norman. Mark Way also has this question. He says, an individual is currently in uncollectible status. Is it wise to file an offer in compromise for such a client if their condition will remain the same for a long time?
Well, currently non-collectible status is usually, it's a temporary thing. That's why it's called currently. It's not permanently non-collectible. And it's usually 2 years. So I wouldn't see the point of submitting an offer while the taxpayer's in currently non-collectible status, because, well, one thing is currently non-collectible status doesn't toll the CSAT. So the collection statute continues to run out for 2 years, where when you submit an offer, that offer does toll the CSAT from the date that the offer was received until the date that the offer was rejected plus 30 days, because you have 30 days to appeal. So I would wait till they get a notice that the currently non-collectible status is expired and they want an update in financials, and then I would prepare the updated financials at that time and submit an offer then. Because I think you'd want to take advantage of the currently non-collectible status and allow the CSAT to keep running before you submit the offer and stop the clock.
Right. Okay, Mark, wait, there you go. Moving on to the next one. This is from Dinesh. Dinesh has a very generic question, but we'll do our best to answer here. It's, what is the best way to reopen an IRS audit?
Right, so the reason it's generic is because I don't know at what stage the audit is. Have they received the 30-day letter? Have they received the notice of the 90-day letter, the notice of deficiency? Because if the 90 days haven't expired, you can file a petition in U.S. tax court. And what happens is that gets assigned to area counsel, but then it's going to go to a settlement officer or appeals officer, and that's going to reopen the audit. So if the 30 days is available, then you're going to reopen it with the auditor directly by producing new information, you know, receipts for disallowed expenses or whatever. If the 90 days is pending, then I would file a petition in tax court. If the 90 days have run, and so the tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the case, I would file an offer doubt as to liability, and I would submit documentation to support that wasn't available or in the original audit, and an offer doubt as to liability, you would only offer the amount that you actually believe you owe. So you would submit your documentation and maybe like an amended return or something to show that you don't have documentation for all your expenses, for instance, but you do for the majority of them, and so that you admit to owing some liability because there's some expenses that you can't prove, but the expenses that you can prove, you want that reduced. So you would submit the offer doubt as the liability, and that would go to an offer specialist, and then that would go to an examiner, and that would be like another audit, and that would give you another bite of the apple too. So depending on where the case is, it's either submitting documentation within 30 days to the auditor, filing a petition to tax court within 90 days from the notice of deficiency, or submitting a offer doubt as to liability if it's over 90 days.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Before we move on to the next one, I do get a lot of follow-up questions, and some of you are submitting a few follow-up questions here in the questions box, in the chat box. Take advantage of our VIP membership. We typically offer this with a two-month free trial. My marketing department just approved an additional month as a holiday gift for everyone in attendance today. So the VIP membership now is a three-month free trial, which will carry you out till March, and you can take advantage of the consultation time, the e-learning courses, the video on demand, the webinars that are available so you can learn more detail all the subjects that we're talking about today. Again, we just got the approval to offer a three-month free trial. I'm pushing the link now. So for those of you who are interested, go ahead and sign up. This is only good until this Friday, so take advantage of it right away. Again, this is the VIP membership. Comes with 3 hours of consultation time. You get access to our video on demand, our comprehensive library, including white papers. You get access to the knowledge base, the e-learning courses, the webinars. Check out the website for more information, and I'm pushing the link now. So let's go ahead and move on. This is from Becky, is asking, a taxpayer had an installment agreement in place for the years 2009 to 2015. IRS issued a notice to terminate the installment agreement. He filed his 2016 return and showed significantly higher income, which is why we suspect the IA was being terminated. What options do we have to reinstate the existing installment agreement?
So first of all, usually when you get that notice of intent to terminate an installment agreement, it gives one of two reasons. Either they missed the payment or they incurred additional tax liability. Usually if you started making more money, that wouldn't necessarily terminate the installment agreement. It would kick you out of currently non-collectible. But I think in an installment agreement, which is a full pay, I'm assuming this is a full pay installment agreement. In other words, that the terms of the installment agreement would full pay the tax liability within the CSAD, that the notice should state why they're terminating it. If it's because they missed a payment, you can call and correct that and get reinstated. And I think there's like a $34 reinstatement fee or something that's just added to the tax liability. If it's because they owed, I mean, when they filed 2016 and they showed more income, did they owe anything? It could even be a small amount. Remember, if they filed it on extension, it could be penalties and interest from April 15th. So I would call the number on the notice and find out why the installment agreement is about to be terminated, and correct whatever it is. And you may need to submit updated financials. If you're dealing with ACS over the phone, they want a 433F, unlike a revenue officer who wants the more inclusive 433A, ACS will accept a 433F. But I wouldn't necessarily assume that it's because they had higher income in 16. It could be because either they owe tax for 16 or they missed the payment. But I'd find out and correct whatever's wrong.
All right. Robert is asking, I've submitted an offer in compromise last month and waiting for the IRS to confirm receipt or acceptance. How long will this take, and will it toll the statute while being reviewed?
Yeah, so they're very slow at offers these days. They have, I think, less people working than they used to. So one thing you could do is order the account transcript, and you could look, and the account transcript will show if the offer's been received or not. But it could be 6 months or more from the time that the IRS receives the offer to the time that the offer is assigned to an offer specialist. And yes, the time that the offer is pending, which means if you look at the transcript, the date that the offer has been received, that tolls the statute on collection. That tolls the CSAD. So what you want to do probably is get a account transcript and see if it's been received or not. And hopefully you do what we do, and that is whenever we send out an offer or basically anything to the IRS, we send it certified mail so we can track it. So that if you sent it certified, you don't need a return receipt. You just need a tracking number, so that you can track it online and see that the IRS has received it. And then you want to check the account transcript and see that they received it. And then you'll receive a letter acknowledging that they received the offer, but saying that they need 90 days to assign it to a specialist. And often what happens now is we get another letter after 90 days saying they need another 90 days. And that's just to get assigned to the offer specialist, and then the offer specialist can sit on it for another 6 months. So it's not unusual that a year has passed before we even have any contact with the offer specialist. And all that time, the clock stopped on the collection statute.
All right, so moving on to the next one, it's another offer question. So this is definitely a popular topic here. IRS just denied an offer I submitted earlier this year, stating that the taxpayer can full pay the liability. My guess is that they are basing their decision on the 2016 filed return. His situation has deteriorated since 2016, as reflected on the offer, and even today is worse still. Can you share how to best appeal this decision? I've never appealed an OIC denial before. And before you answer, Jeffrey, if you're on the line, let us know just so that we can get a gauge as to what everyone else is experiencing when you submitted this offer earlier this year. So I'm assuming it was very early, either January or February, to be able to finally get an answer now. So let us know what you're experiencing there.
So we just appealed an offer that was denied. And so there is an appeal process. The letter denying the offer should have explained what the appeal rights were, and hopefully it's not too late to appeal it. I think it's sent to back to the offer specialist, and then they send it to appeals. It could be based on 2016, but they should have told you why it was rejected. There's a table that they show with income and expenses, and then they project disposable income for the life of the collection statute, and oftentimes that's how they determine that the taxpayer has the ability to full pay, either based on disposable income or value of assets, that if there's equity in the home or if they have equity in other property, then they look at what that property could be sold for and the equity applied to the tax liability. But there may be issues about the value of the assets or the income or expenses. So you want to appeal that denied offer within the appeal rights. Otherwise, you lose it, and what you would have to do is file another appeal. And if the taxpayer's situation has deteriorated, then the new 433A OIC should show the current condition, and maybe you could submit an offer even less than you did before. But if the appeal right period is still there, you probably want to appeal it before that expires.
All right, next one here is from Rebecca. Rebecca says, client owes $270,000, including interest and penalties. I've heard you mention before that if the liability exceeds $250,000, you can request to have the case assigned to a revenue officer. We just received a notice of intent to levy. Is it too late to request the RO? What advantages/disadvantages can I expect in dealing with an RO?
Okay, so, yeah, that notice of intent to levy, it's not too late. That's sent out by ACS, Automated Collections. So what you want to do is call the number on the notice and say that the taxpayer qualifies for assignment of the case to a revenue officer and you want the case assigned to the field. And they'll look and determine whether or not the taxpayer qualifies. There's a couple of things. One is compliance. Sometimes they won't assign it to a revenue officer if the taxpayer is not making estimated payments or if they're not in compliance for 2017. And also, the thing about 270, you say it includes interest and penalties. Sometimes they say that's a $250,000. It has to be $250,000 in assessed tax. that that's the tax portion without the penalties and interest. It really depends who you talk to. So the first step is to call the number on the notice and ask that the case be assigned to a local revenue officer. And if it is, in here in Southern California, it can take 6 months from the date that the case is put in queue for a revenue officer till you actually hear from a revenue officer. And once it's in queue for a revenue officer, the case is out of ACS, which means that ACS won't be collecting. So there won't be any computer-generated bank levies or wage levies.
All right. We're getting towards the end here, guys, so I'm going to be opening it up to the callers or the people participating today. Charles, George, River, and Greg, I already have you guys submitting your questions, so we're going to try to get to you right away. For those of others that want to submit, go ahead and submit your questions now or let us know that you want to come on live. Just have a couple more questions here to get through. So next one is from Clinton. Clinton is an EA, and he's asking, when an examiner requests an extension to the statute of limitations to complete an audit, how should we base that decision? Why would it ever be in the client's interest to agree? Can't the SOL be extended after the audit is complete if more time is needed by the Office of Appeals? What are the pros and the cons?
No, you know, right, at first blush, I understand your question. Why would you agree to extending the statute of limitations? And the answer is because if you don't, then the auditor is just going to submit an audit report, and it's going to be more disfavorable to your client, and then you're going to have to appeal it, and it's going to be more time and more money that it's easier just to extend, to agree to extend the statute and work with the auditor. Remember, it only extends it for a certain period of time and only extends it for the year that you're, that they're specifically asking. It's not a general extension. And the reason why you want to do it is because you want to be able to work with the auditor without having it hanging over your head and having them prematurely issue a report that's more unfavorable to your client than if you spent more time and got them the information they needed to audit the return properly.
All right. Hopefully that answers the question there, Clinton. If not, take advantage of that trial membership and give us a call. We'll set up a time for consultation with you. Moving on to Charles. If you guys remember in the beginning, Charles was asking about a FOIA request, and he's clarified now. He says it's a FOIA request for determining why an installment agreement was pending for 4 years. So, Norman, he wants to know how he can determine what information he should include. And I don't know if a FOIA is the right way to find this information out, but he wants to know why an installment agreement was pending for 4 years.
Yeah, it could have dropped through the cracks, or there could have been, I don't know, was it with ACS or was it assigned to a revenue officer? Because we've had some revenue officer cases go on forever. I guess you could do a FOIA request to ask for, like, the revenue officer's notes in the case and find out why, but
he just responded saying it's ACS. ACS.
It is ACS. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, what finally happened? I mean, why are you asking for the FOIA request? Is it still pending so that you want to find out what took so long? And in the meantime, was there a hold on collection? So have they been collecting from the taxpayer this whole time? I mean,
doesn't the pending request toll the statute of limitations?
Right, it's tolling the statute. What? And so they haven't been collecting from it.
That's what he's saying. He's saying that the CSED was extended for the 4 years.
And when he calls ACS, they don't know why. So what's the question? Is that something that would be, is that something that you might get information from when should a FOIA request be made? Yeah, so I would get the transcript, and I would show that, and I would submit the FOIA request with the transcript showing that an installment agreement request was submitted 4 years ago, and it's still open.
Is there ever a chance to dispute the amount of time something like this is taking? Because it's the disadvantage on the taxpayer. The statute of limitation gets extended when they take this long.
Right, but on the other hand, they haven't been collecting. And, you know, the taxpayer is always free to make voluntary payments. So while that's not a bad idea either, that while an installment agreement is pending, that the taxpayer make payments in the amount that they're requesting the installment agreement for, because that shows the taxpayer has the ability to make that payment, and it gives you a talking point to say, you know, my guy's been making payments of $100 a month for the last couple of years. That's what he's comfortable doing. We'd like to continue at that point. So has he been making voluntary payments? I mean, you know, there's really two ways of looking at it. But at this point, the question really is find out what's holding it up, and a FOIA request may help. Otherwise, I don't know how much tax is owed. Is it enough to request that it be assigned to a revenue officer, for instance?
So what we'll do, Charles?
Or is there enough? Or is it low enough where it could be qualify for a streamline, and just, you know, withdraw this installment agreement request and just submit a request for a streamlined installment agreement?
Right. All right, Charles. So what we'll do is we'll do a follow-up with you. You can call us in the office, and I'll try to schedule a call with Norman to address this a little bit further, just to get you the answers that you need. Moving on to...
There's just too many unanswered questions. I don't want to take up a lot of time.
Right.
So, yeah, Charles, just call me, and we'll work it out.
Moving on to River. River says, thanks for taking my question. I've been attending these events every chance I get, and I picked up a lot of good pointers, hoping you can help me with the long-time client I have. This is a notorious procrastinator. He's late in getting the information to prepare the returns, does not make estimated tax payments, and continues to add to his tax bill. I want to be able to create a permanent solution for some of the older years he owes and believe they now qualify to be discharged in bankruptcy, approximately $60,000. Is BK similar to an offer where he has to be in compliance after BK for a certain amount of time? What tolling events should I look out for?
Yeah, so no, bankruptcy doesn't require compliance, but it does. You do need to look out for tolling events. So the first thing you do is order an account transcript, and then go through the transcript and see if there's anything that would have told, not the collection statute. For bankruptcy, it's the three-year rule, which is 3 years from the due date of the return. So the due date of return is either April of the following year or October of the following year from the tax year that you're trying to discharge. And that could be told if there were appeals pending, or if the taxpayer was out of the country, or if they filed bankruptcy before, or if they submitted offers, or even if they submit a request for an installment agreement. So there are a lot of things you need to look on in the transcript to determine if the three-year rule was told or not. The second one is the two-year rule, which says that it has to be more than 2 years from when the return was filed. So if the return was timely filed, then the two-year rule really doesn't kick in, because the three-year rule would take care of it. But if the return was filed more than a year later than the due date of the return, then you need to look at the two-year rule. And that can be told too. And then you have to look at the 180 days from the assessment date, and there could be multiple assessment dates. There could be assessment on the return. There could be additional assessments. There could be audit assessments. There could be penalty assessments. So you need to look at all the different assessments and look at the dates and make sure that more than 180 days have passed from the date of those assessments. And so the question really seems to be about the tolling events, which we answered, and is there a compliance issue? And the answer is no.
All right. Thank you, Norman. George is asking, 1120 Corporation owes 941 taxes, 120,000 with penalties and interest for 2015 through 2017. 1120 closed in June 2017, so this is a closed business with net operating losses. The owner is 85-year-old widow. Husband died in 2015. How do you force the IRS to charge the trust fund recovery penalty to her individually and not to follow up on the entire liability from the corporation? Revenue officer just showed up 2 weeks ago. So the question, okay. Yeah, it's about...
Right. So the thing is, if a business is like a sole prop, then there is no trust fund recovery penalty assessed because the owner of the sole proprietorship owes the entire payroll tax liability. But if it's a corporation, then they're going to do a 4180 interview to determine responsible person. If she's a responsible person, then they're going to assess only the trust fund against her, not the whole amount. So that if the corporation's closed, then the IRS is just going to have to write off, and there's no assets to the corporation, I'm assuming. And hopefully the corporation with the state, is it suspended or did they close officially? Did they wind down? That's what I'm trying to say. Corporation has to wind down business with the Secretary of State. So did the corporation properly wind down its business and that there's no assets remaining? And then the owner can only be assessed a trust fund recovery penalty and not the non-trust fund portion of the payroll tax liability.
All right, George. So hopefully that clarifies it. It's a matter of making sure the corporation was properly closed.
So you really don't have to force it. That's the liability. Unless for some reason it wasn't a corp, it was a sole proprietorship or
disregarded entity. Yeah.
Right, or something else. But if it was a legitimate corporation, they're not going to assess the whole liability against the owner.
Okay, I think we have time for one more, and this one is from Keith. Keith says he's got a client, has a large liability, approximately $300,000 since 2010. She appealed assessment in tax court in 2012 and lost. Can she now file for BK since it's been over 6 years since original tax was assessed?
Okay, so again, the rules on discharging taxes, the bankruptcy are the 3-year rule, the 2-year rule, and the 180-day rule, and those times are told by appeals, so I don't know how long it was in tax court. So, like, I would need to look at the transcript and do what we call a tax dischargeability analysis, where I do a chart and determine the tolling and when the tax is dischargeable. I mean, can I answer yes or no based on what you told me? No, but I can tell. I mean, no, I can't tell you. No, that it's not dischargeable, but you would need to do an analysis and keep in mind that the time from when the tax court petition was filed until the decision was entered And then you have to add 30 days to that because you can appeal tax court decisions in Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's tolled for the time that it was with the U.S. Tax Court plus the appeal period, whether or not it was appealed or not. So you need to do an analysis, but 2010, the tax return would have been filed in 2011. So the due date would have been 2011. But I don't know when the case went to tax court, because if it went to tax court after, for instance, 2014, then the 3 years already ran. So there would be no tolling of the three-year rule because the three-year rule had already expired by the time that the tax court petition was filed. So I don't know if the tax court petition was filed before or after 2014. Those are the kinds of things you'd have to look at.
All right, Keith, thank you very much for the question. Hopefully that addressed it. Again, for those of you who have follow-up questions or need a little more information, take advantage of the free trial that we pushed in the chat box. We are extending the free trial instead of 2 months, offering it for 3 months as a holiday gift to you guys that are attending, but you must sign up by this Friday. Click on the link to register for it. I'm making the registration here to make sure that everyone that's on here can get the offer. We will be sending an email wrapping up this call and making sure that you all have access to the trial. Again, we are going to go dark in January, so next Practitioners Forum is going to be February 6th, so please mark your calendars. Thank you all for attending. I hope you picked up some good pointers here and learned some valuable information. Give us a call. Send us an email. Any questions that you continue to have, we're more than happy to help you. Thank you all very much, and happy holidays.